Before we begin, we have a short announcement. For all our world-class listeners in the D.C. area, we are hosting a special event at the National Press Club on Thursday, July 26th. North Korea and nuclear experts Scott Sagan, Gi-Wok Shen, and Kathleen Stevens will sit down for a panel discussion called North Korea, Now What? The event will be moderated by FSI director and world-class host Michael McFaul. We'll explore the challenges ahead for America's relationship with the DPRK. It's free and open to the public, but space is limited. For a link to the registration page, visit our website, fsi.stanford.edu. Now on to the show. You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Mike Osborne. Today's episode is a rebroadcast of a piece we first published in December 2016. Back in November of 2016, shortly after Donald Trump's election, FSI's Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law co-hosted a panel with Stanford's Center for Latin American Studies. At the event, Latin scholars, students, and staff discussed what Donald Trump's election would mean for the U.S. southern border. Despite all the events in the past year and a half, including the recent election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador to serve as the next Mexican president, this panel discussion remains incredibly relevant.
My name is Alberto Díaz-Calleros. I am a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute and the director of the Center for Latin American Studies. So today we are here in a panel on what the U.S. election means for both sides of the border. We thought it was a very important challenge to think a little bit, in different levels about the aftermath of the election, of the U.S. election. And in some ways, part of the motivation for this panel is to think from very different perspectives about the implications of the election and the sort of the presidential term of Donald Trump coming up for Latinos and Latinas, both on the U.S. side, but also for Latin America and for Latin Americans. So in a way, you know, we wanted to combine a series of issues, a series of questions. We think that none of us are experts on any of these questions. We really don't have, enough understanding, I think, of many of the things that have unfolded and many of the things that we maybe were not too acute observers of the processes that were unfolding and then culminated in the election. So I have to say from the very beginning that a lot of this is all of us trying to make sense of a lot of the things that have happened. I will introduce our panelists and also our co-chair of the co-moderator of the panel. But I want to say that this is an effort that is being co-sponsored by the Freeman Spogli Institute, by the Center for Latin American Studies, and also by the Service Employees International Union Local 2007, which is our local service employees union. So my co-moderator is Francisco Preciado. He is the executive director of SEIU Local 2007, of which Stanford Service Workers are the members. He is one of our proud graduates. He got a bachelor's degree, a dual bachelor's degree in political science and Chicano studies from Stanford University. It was not just yet Chicano Latino studies, I guess. And he also got his degree in the Berkeley School of Law. So he obviously comes with all the academic credentials. And for those of you who might have seen it, he also, you know, fulfilled one of the biggest dreams of his father, who is still a gardener, I understand, in the Stanford grounds.
My dad's here. He's right there.
He's right here. Okay. Then we have Angela Garcia, who's an assistant professor of anthropology. She works on different institutional and historical processes of violence and suffering. A central question that she has been addressing is the question of addiction, depression, and incarceration in poor families and communities. And what is remarkable about her work is she really has the perspective on both sides of the border. She has worked both on the Mexican side and on the U.S. side, looking at these therapeutic worlds in the context of urban poverty and criminal violence. Beatriz Magaloni is Associate Professor of Political Science. She's also a Senior Fellow at FSI, and she is in charge of a program called Poverty and Governance. She studies questions of poverty reduction, criminal violence, with a specific focus in Latin America, combining a multi-method approach. And right now, she is one of the co-PIs in a very large project looking at citizen trust and police accountability in Mexico. Paula Moya is currently the director of the Research Institute for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity. She's a professor in English, and she has been focusing her research on studying different aspects of feminist theory, critical theory, but with a particular emphasis on the questions of identity, race, and ethnicity for the Chicano Latina studies. We also have one of our students, Lenica Morales Valenzuela, who will join us. Oh, there she is. So Lenica is here. She told me that she was going to have to arrive a little bit late because she does have obligations as a student that she had to fulfill. But she's a graduate student in the Latin American Masters right now. She has a BA in Romance Languages and Literatures and a second one in Archaeology from Harvard. And she has been very interested in questions about the genocide survivors in the Guatemalan Civil War, as well as issues of peace across Maya communities in Central America. Mm-hmm. So this is our panel, and we want to start, the mechanics is the following. We want to start with some questions that Francisco or Frankie?
The race, man.
Okay. Francisco and I are going to ask a few questions to our panelists, and then we want to open it up to the public. You have a sheet of paper. If you could write a question in the back of that, and I think a couple of people are going to be collecting them, and hopefully that way we can get some conversation going through your questions. Okay, so Francisco.
Great. So I wanted to start with a pretty direct question, but it's open-ended, so you can incorporate your thoughts. The president-elect has shown a propensity to lie and distort facts in order to serve his interests. What steps do you think he needs to take in order to build relationships with Latin American leaders?
It's an open-ended question.
I'll just start because somebody has to. I think part of the difficulty that we're facing is we don't know if he wants to build relationships with Latin American leaders. He had the one television opportunity with the president of Mexico, which a lot of people wonder how wise that was of the president of Mexico to do that. And it worked well for him, certainly for Trump. So I don't know, it's an open question. I mean, the rhetoric around Mexicans in particular has suggested that the population of people that go by, that are attribute to which that name is attributed, are serving a particular rhetorical position in this whole thing that has not a whole lot to do with the reality of the people's lives or where they fit into the economic system or anything. So I guess part of the question is simply whether Trump is at all interested.
So we just go.
If you have a comment on this, I think it would be.
It's related to the issue you are bringing up. It's really more broadly speaking about what he will do in office. So during the campaign, he insulted a lot of people and he made promises. I mean, in regards to Mexico and Mexican Americans, so deport millions of migrants, build a wall, and also renegotiate NAFTA. And these were, you know, probably the three clearest points that he made in relationship to Mexicans and Latinos and our community. And after these 2-3 weeks, you know, just listening to what he's saying now, and also just thinking about the feasibility of all these promises, it just makes us think that it's really uncertain what he's going to do and whether he can do what he, you know, sort of promised in the campaign. I think that the damage is already done. Regardless of whether he really deports as many people as he's saying or whether he builds a wall or not, which I think is going to be very difficult to do. And the damage is done in the way the American community relates to Mexicans and Latinos, and the way Latinos see themselves as members of this, you know, sort of this country. I think the damage is done regardless of whether these promises are fulfilled. And I think that more than anything, what I see is really the damage in the social fabric that we already are witnessing, in how, you know, kids are attacking Latinos, are attacking minorities at school. And you hear a lot of different instances around the country of these hate and this racism just, you know, exploding in different dimensions. And I think that's already the damage that is, you know, that is being done. Whether Trump is going to do all the things that he promised, I frankly think that it's going to be much harder. And then we are going to be talking more about that. Each of these promises are not easy to fulfill, fortunately. But already the damage is being, you know, also is being experienced in Mexico as well, and we will talk more about that, I think, during this conversation.
I think I would just add one thing, which is not so much what must he do to rebuild relationships or to build them if he's actually interested in that, but what must we do? And I'm reminded of Charles Blow's recent editorial in the New York Times, where he's not ready to jump to this idea that he's going to be a normal president and that we're going to sort of trust what he does and we're going to facilitate the process of normalization, but actually we are going to keep him accountable on every score, and we will be watching him and not trusting him and not believing him. And so I think that connected to your question of what must he do is what should we be doing? And I think maintaining an attitude of deep skepticism and distrust is important, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate what pretty much everyone has been saying, I think the Trump presidency has pretty much just, for Latinos specifically, Latinos and Latin American people, there's just been a huge question mark onto what kind of issues he's going to tackle next. And the United States as a country has a lot of agreements and a lot of issues that it wants to tackle, prominent issues within Latin America, such as human rights. You know, is that going to be an issue in a Trump presidency, or is it going to be an issue within American borders? Yeah, North American borders. But yeah, there's a huge question mark. We don't know what's going to happen on day one. We don't know what's going to happen on day 100, you know? And vigilance is definitely something that we as citizens need to start taking up.
Can I ask, just reverse the question a little bit, and starting with you, Lenica?
Great.
I'm sorry. But how are the Latin American leaders preparing themselves? It's kind of reversing the same question. So thinking about Guatemala, for example, Lenica, that you follow very closely the events in mm-hmm. Guatemala, is the Guatemalan leadership getting ready for like a policy, you know, plan of what they want to do, of how they're going to face, or they're just are so busy just getting their act together?
Yeah.
And the same thing for Mexico, you know, having invited Trump in the Peña Nieto administration or the other Latin American leaders, do we see any space of leadership in Latin America of the leaders that are emerging to make a counterpoint? The way, for example, we're seeing with the California leaders. The California, I think, clearly, you know, there's been such clear statements from the Senate, from the House, from, you know, different levels of leadership in California. Do we see any of that in Latin America?
Well, I think that diplomacy definitely plays a role in this. I think after President-elect Trump got elected into power, you saw a lot of world leaders congratulating him at the end of this race. And I don't think that was necessarily their first choice of who they would like to see in power in the United States, but definitely diplomacy had to play a hand in it in terms of rule of law and recognizing the role that the United States as a country has to play within this international realm. specifically in terms of Guatemala, I think for Jimmy Morales, who is the current president of Guatemala, I think there are such robust issues of corruption that he's had to face and had to answer to in the previous administration of Otto Perez Molina and within his current administration, that there I don't think he has necessarily come up with a plan to answer to some of the issues that President-elect Trump has put forth. In Guatemala, unfortunately, corruption is at the end all and be all of our politics right now and what we're considering.
Can I come back to the question of the damage already being done that you brought up? And I think you're absolutely right about that. I think sometimes people underplay the extent to which rhetoric has these social effects and really affect the well-being of people against whom the hatred is directed. So I think and as you've indicated, you know, we've already seen those videos of, you know, young people in gymnasiums chanting "build that wall" as a way of bullying the visiting Latino team members, or even bullying their fellow schoolmates. You know, and so I do, in terms of how this is going to affect Latinos living in the United States, I think that we are going to see increased incidence of high blood pressure, of debilitating illness, of anxiety. You know, I've already heard a lot of stories about children being afraid either that their parents are going to be taken away. And for people who live in mixed families where some people are undocumented, that's a very real issue. Or being afraid that they're going to be locked up themselves. So, I mean, in thinking of how we respond, because I think, Angela, you're absolutely right, that we need to think about how we respond to this. At the very least, we need to learn how to stand with and for each other, whether we're documented or undocumented, or whether we're Muslim, whether we're African American. We need to stand with and for each other. We need, I think, to cultivate a sense of shared fate so that we understand the way to which, wherever we are positioned as Latinos, whatever our status is, that because of the way we're positioned by others, we share some of the contingencies that are going to be coming our way. But the other thing is, I think we need to not underplay the importance of kindness and love that we can show each other, because we are going to be absorbing, and we already have been absorbing, a lot of hate. And so I think that being kind to each other and being loving to each other is something that we have to be very deliberate about. And that may sound kind of touchy-feely, but we're going to need to leverage that as a resource against what we've been getting.
So you mentioned Californian leaders, and I think that is the right reaction. I think that all those statements of mayors, of, you know, police departments, leaders in California saying we are not going to change our policies, we are going to continue to, you know, serve as, you know, a community that receives and protects Latinos here, we're going to continue with our sanctuary policies and so on. This is really the right approach, if that should be reassuring to a lot of Latinos who live in California. But I don't see that happening, obviously, in many other states. So those who are here are, in a way, lucky, you know, compared to Arizona or, you know, in many other states. But I don't see that same reaction in Latin America. I mean, I think Mexico is the one country that is most directly impacted, although this really relates to all the, you know, sort of Latin American community. But in a way, it's more directed to Mexico because of NAFTA and because of the idea of the wall. And as I say, that affects Central America as well, but I don't see leaders in Mexico really standing up as the Californian leaders have done. And I think that when Peña Nieto invited Trump, as you know, there was a big disappointment. People were so upset that he was sort of willing to go along with the insults and receiving, you know, Donald Trump in Mexico. And I think that he had the opportunity to reflect, you know, after people reacted in such a strong way, to see, you know, what type of leader I want to be. And I don't see any. I think they are frightened of the economy, and they know that Mexico's economy is so tied to the United States that they really don't want to play harder. But I think that's the thing that they should be doing. Our economies are anyway so well integrated that it's not going to be easy just to, you know, tear them apart. So there should be a lot of things that they could be should be doing, but they are not doing. And I think this is this really talks very poorly of our president in Mexico, unfortunately.
Sure. So. Given the fact that the president-elect tends to change his mind relatively quickly, sometimes over Twitter at 3 a.m, for example, and it's important for people to organize to combat this hate, what policies do you suggest that people focus on to stop, given that there's so many issues, there's so many things, and 1 second he might be for something, and then the next minute against? So how do you suggest people focus their attention in terms of combating his policy agenda?
Well, I'll take the lead on this one. I think this isn't just pertaining to Latin Americans, Latinos, or anything like that. This pertains to the citizens of the United States, you know? I think specifically this type of actions that we should take as citizens is take up causes or take up issues that are closest to our hearts, the things that we're most passionate about. Because let us be frank, this is going to not be a one-day battle or a week-long battle or a one-year-long battle. It's going to be a 4 years, you know, maybe less.
Maybe two.
But, like, if the scenario plays out the way that it's historically played out most of the time, it's going to be 4 long years, you know? And so it's going to be a marathon of what issue do you find yourself most passionate about? What is your stance on it? And do not budge. You know, this is a man who has changed his mind at 3 a.m. He Googles things and finds out what they actually are and then flip-flops again. So regardless of what his stance is, whatever your stance is as an individual for your cause, stick with that, persist in that. Fight for that every single day for the next 4 years. Because no matter what he does, you know where you stand, and you know what your issue is. And you know the most, as long as you know what you're doing intimately, I think it's very hard for someone to fight an individual who is well-informed and unwilling to move.
I think also, in addition to just sort of, you know, focusing on where one feels most strongly, is also, this is an opportunity for coalition building. I think the fact that, you know, this is an interdisciplinary forum, we have a lot of different representation here, but we all have a shared concern is speaks to opportunities for building coalition. And for me, I mean, I've been very involved with issues of addiction and drug policy reform, which are related to sort of sentencing reform, and also immigration reform. And I see the Trump presidency as an opportunity for people that have been working on immigration reform and drug policy reform to come together and work together, because it's very clear that his plan of deporting up to 3 million people depends on the broadening of certain categories of criminals, many of whom are going to be low-level drug offenders. And the person that he's tapped as attorney general has a horrific track record when it comes to drug policy reform and sentencing reform. And so, you know, in April, I was at a meeting at the UN on special sessions on drugs, and a lot of Latin Americans who were there were asking me about the election and what's going to happen. I was like, don't worry, it's not going to be Trump. Even though I have concerns with Clinton, it won't be as bad. And now here we are. And so I really hope that, you know, people who work, who've had an issue, will continue to have it, but will also recognize how incredibly intertwined they are with other issues that perhaps they've avoided. And, you know, there's strength in numbers, as we we know now with this election. So, and I think immigration reform and drug policy reform really have to be thought together in the next, 4 to 8 years with the future president.
I think in addition to that, which you're absolutely right about that, is I've been thinking about this lately, which is that we need to get more serious about electoral politics. Like the Democrats they need to get smarter about their electoral politics. There are two issues that I see to be a real problem. One is gerrymandering, which I don't know how much people understand about that issue, but as a young woman, I was involved in electoral politics and at the state level, and so that it was at that level that they were drawing these districts. And I could really see how they could do things to basically get the results they want. And Republicans have been working on that for 10 years or so, or longer. They've been working on creating districts that only Republicans can win. The other thing that is a real problem is the Voting Rights Act, the fact that it is no longer being enforced in a serious way, that the minute that certain states were taken, the oversight was taken away, the Republicans, and I mean, this is a fact, I'm not just, immediately went after things like closing polls early, not having early voting. It's active voter suppression. And so I think part of the difficulty is that, everybody knows that Clinton won the popular vote. Okay, so Clinton won the popular vote, and somehow Democrats are completely out of power now. What is that about? And I think it has everything to do with not doing the ground level, day to day, door to door, work that is required to not end up in this situation. And this is, since I was involved in electoral politics as a young woman, I've seen it up close. It's ugly. There's nothing pretty about it. I don't like it. But you have to make all kinds of compromises. You can't be as nice and radical as you want to be and all that sort of stuff. But, otherwise, this is where we end up.
So one last point. In addition, I think, to what you just said, I mentioned that to me the immediate damage that we already have seen is really in the social fabric and the way people relate to each other. And that to me is really... It's very worrisome. I come from a country where the social fabric has really disintegrated, and there is so much violence going on, and there is so much people don't work with each other. And I see that the plan that Trump put in this country. I mean, obviously there has always been problems with racism. There has always been problems with how people relate to each other, especially in a society that is so diverse. Mm-hmm. But, that's to me the most worrisome and immediate concern, mm-hmm. that it just made it possible to express hate, made it possible to just, start bullying each other in school and things like that. So if you think where I would work, that's where I would put my bet, is really working with the social fabric, which is really not easy to do, but it's working with children in school, working with how Latinos should be proud of who they are, and making all the it's more on this symbolic sort of what it means to be a Latino in this country, that you have to give the example and make people feel proud. And those things to me are important. How Latinos are, incredible in the arts, incredible in cinema, incredible in all these, all these contributions. And just to focus on those and spread that, in addition to the politics, which I think is it's incredibly important.
Yes. No, I mean, I totally agree.
So here's the political
agree.
Scientist. Yes. And you can see
well, I, you what's know, happening I, here. I mean, my own scholarship is devoted to teaching literature that precisely yes. does what you're calling for. Yes. So, in talking about electoral politics is my way of reminding myself that I can't just do my own little thing, but I have yes. to work across. With people outside my discipline to make change.
So before we open to
questions from you. I do want to ask one question. Oh, Frankie, you had another one.
Oh, good.
I do want to ask a question a little bit to the whole panel. I had thought it's a little bit more for Paola, but now I think I should ask it for everyone. So the question is a little bit, what does it mean in this, you know, post whatever Trump era? What would you say we have to articulate as what it means to be American? And this is very important for me because I became a citizen this summer. I voted for the first time. In spite of all my ambivalence as a kind of Latin American leftist, you know, I had this kind of very difficult, complex relationship with this country that is where my children were born and where, you know, has been very good for me. And that summer, I was so happy and so proud of being an American. And I want to ask, you know, what should we be articulating at what it means to be an American? Because I think there will be some very tough fights ahead on that question.
Well, I think you're right. We need to decide what it means to be American. We need to create the America that we want to see. And so that means standing up for ourselves as American in all of our complexity. Mm-hmm. There is a news, I don't know, the New York Times, which I'm mad at, but in any case, the New York Times has this feature called race/related that you can sign up for. And I noticed that the last time they sent something out, it was sort of like My America. And it was profiles of a bunch of different people, you know, sort of talking about what their America was. And it was obviously a very diverse America. So I think we need to stand up for both all the good things that we are as Latino, but saying this is who we are and we are American. We're, you know, in all our complexity.
I think also, I mean, I know that I personally feel embarrassed. I feel depressed. I feel ashamed. I'm confused. How did this happen? And I've had a lot of classes with my undergraduate students and my graduate students where we've cried about this, and where they've voted for the first time too. And this is, it wasn't like voting for Obama, you know, for them. It was like voting for Trump, you know, seeing their vote not matter, they felt. And I think I absolutely agree we need to celebrate the diversity, celebrate being Latinos and all that we contribute. But I also think this is a very instructive moment. The shame and the embarrassment and the despair that people feel is also what it means to be an American today. And so I don't want to jump to just celebrating, you know, our complexity and diversity. I think that there's something here in the darkness that is really instructive, and that actually we can figure out how to mobilize in order to articulate a kind of a future vision that won't lead us to where we have found ourselves. And so, you know, there's been a lot of calls for self-care in communities, and I think that these are so important in caring for others. And I also think that just, you know, sticking in the darkness a little bit and really trying to figure out what is it telling us about where we have come is also a really important exercise.
Yeah, I think it's also important, like, to recognize, like, we tend to be a very diverse population, you know, and diversity is very synonymous with progress, you know, progress of this country. We have this rhetoric of the United States needs to be the leader of progress for the world. And oftentimes, I think with this, I think to myself that this election has pretty much brought to light the people who get lost in that rhetoric of progress. You know, which American citizens are we not talking about in middle America? Like, we saw on that electoral map, we saw like California, Boston, Rhode Island, you know, all of those states that went blue, and suppose there's a huge Latino contingency, there are like huge and diverse populations, but there's also that middle America, that big chunk of red, you know, that, that, you know, like, for better or for worse, they are also American, you know, they are part of the USA. And you got to think about, like, what leads to such polarized views of what our country and our nation is and isn't. You know, who gets to be American and who doesn't get to be American? Who gets to be progressive and who doesn't get to be progressive? Who gets to take part or at least benefit from that progress and who doesn't? Or who believes they don't, you know? And so I think, just kind of to echo what's already been said, like, you know, the USA is not just diversity. It's not just all the Latinos. It's not just the states in blue. It is also the states in red. And so we need to start kind of collaborating and talking with each other. It's like, why do I see the USA completely different from someone else who lives in a red state? You know, like, why is that? You know, and we have to kind of start forming those very human ties and those very human connections and having those very human conversations on what we see life as America as, and why is it so different from me as a Latina to someone else.
Can I say one other thing that I think is really important that we probably do without thinking about it, is we really need to teach media literacy, like really. Like,
oh,
that
absolutely
needs to be one of our top, you know.
Yeah.
So, because it's clear that a lot of people do not know how to evaluate news.
Or just the exercise of thinking critically.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that isn't always as valued when we have to pass some standardized tests when you're in the public school system, you know?
Shall we move to questions from the audience? I think we have a small enough group because we're going to pass along cards, but I think if you can stand up and ask your question, I think we should be able to do that. So we have a question on this side.
You started the conversation by talking about deportation. Some of the major issues that impact us: deportation, NAFTA, and building the wall, if I recall. It's obvious that 50% of the country has opted to come out with strong opinions voiced by Trump. I'd just be interested in your thoughts about compromises that might be palatable and how to steer those.
It's a very difficult question, but a very good one.
Well, I think that speaks more to the issue of immigration throughout the history of the United States, specifically Latino immigration. You know, like, it has become a topic for almost like every election or every candidate who wants the Latino vote, you know? And it's been kind of hard to articulate an immigration reform, immigration policy that satisfies the wants and needs of so many people from different regions of Latin America, from different countries of Latin America coming in. You know, every immigrant from Latin America, some of them come in for similar reasons, some come in for drastically different reasons, you know, and policy reflecting the nuances between those reasons is very difficult. I kind of haven't seen a policy where I'm like, I'm okay with that yet. You know, I haven't seen the ideal policy yet. I haven't heard of a compromise of that, frankly, any politician has put forth in terms of immigration on either side. So that just may be on my perspective. I just haven't seen it. I also haven't gone through a lot of presidents.
Yeah, but this is a really important question because we must be reminded that Obama really deported more Latinos than any other president in the, you know, previous years. So I think that, you know, when we start thinking of what Trump said and what he's going to do, I frankly think that it's really harder to do worse than Obama did in the first, you know, sort of the largest part of his administration. And I think that he did it to compromise with Republicans, and a lot of people were, you know, who supported him were really disappointed in the way he turned his back on Latinos. And then he came to a compromise, which was, you know, I don't know how to pronounce DACA. You
DACA.
Know, so
DACA.
That was, I think that was a decent compromise. And that's what, I think that if Trump undoes that, that's really going to be very painful. And a lot of kids, you know, who were benefited finally from DACA really are very frightened. So that would be, you know, that would be the opposite of compromising. So hopefully he would, you know, keep that as a compromise. But we don't know. Now people are frightened that he, you know, that list is already in the hands of the federal government, and that they are going to target those people. So we are, you know, not sure. But that to me would be a good compromise. In terms of the wall, I don't see any possibility of compromise there. I mean, Mexico is obviously not going to pay for that. And then he's going to confront the problem of how we are going to pay for this wall. Have you seen this? You know, the amount of, you know, of territory that he would have to cover. And also it's very rough, the terrain in most of the areas of, you know, sort of that are not covered by a wall already. So, I mean, this is, to me, ridiculous. I mean, it's not going to happen unless, you know, he's going to put a lot of his, you know, budget deficit is going to go there, which is not going to happen, you know. So what compromise? I mean, using remittances, I mean, that would be another really serious, the opposite of, you know, compromising.
I think one thing, too, to keep in mind is that there's a lot of misinformation about immigration and about immigration rates and about who's coming in and why. And so it's not even possible to begin to talk about compromise until we're actually working with a set of facts that reflects some sort of reality. And that's just the immigration issue is in many ways a red herring that is used to excite racist feeling almost half of Americans either explicitly voted for that or else said, well, it's not a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't mean that feeling should be catered to or respected, because it's not going to solve the fundamental problem, which is what's happening to all those people who feel so disenfranchised. Like, you know, simply trying to, even if we could build a wall, it's not going to solve it.
I did want to make a point, that's okay.
The last one is on NAFTA, and I think that we have heard this not only in the US, but also in Europe, you know, how there are really disappointments with globalization and with trade. And there is a lot of people who have been hurt by these policies. And so I think that's a sign where policies have failed and that there should be some form of compensation to those who are being hurt by globalization. And that's a tricky question that all countries are facing. Because it's very hard to undo economies that are already so deeply integrated, but I think more attention should be paid to those who are losing because of that. And I think that maybe, I see there are two messages in the election. One is that is, you know, the Rust Belt, and that it really went to Trump because this, working class has not been really compensated and benefited. That's one big message, and I think that is possible to compromise with better policies, with better, you know, safety transfers, training, and so on, which they were not paying attention, I think, Democrats or Republicans. And that's a big message. The other message really has to do about what we've been talking more, it's that he brought up racism. And there is, I mean, honestly, it's not all those who voted for Trump, fortunately. But there is a group, we don't know exactly how large it is, that really, you know, that really like this new rhetoric of, you know, white supremacy. And that's the second message that we hear. So with the economic one, I think there is more room to compromise. With the other one, I don't see. I mean, this really, to me, goes so deeply against the values of democracy that there is no room for compromise. Mm-hmm. But I think that should be taken as the message. I mean, Democrats should be learning, and I think they are learning that they failed a lot of their voters.
Francisco wants to bring in
something. No, that's perfect. Actually, just summarize what I wanted to make, that I think everyone understands that you have to compromise on policy issues, But you can't compromise on values, and the values of that all people are created equal, that the America is a multicultural America, that racism is not okay. So you can't compromise on those values, but people wouldn't get it that on policy issues that you can, but on these types of value judgments, you cannot compromise, because you can never say racism is okay sometimes. Like that, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good.
I have another question over there.
Thank you. My question is actually a follow-up to that on the issue of immigration. What are your thoughts on what the future of Latin American immigration will look like? And looking maybe from a different perspective, not so much from policy, but will migration patterns change? Because if there's one thing that's not going to disappear are the problems in Latin America and all over the world. But and also the human persistence to try to provide a better life for your children at whatever cost and wherever that may take you. So, and also keeping in mind in the conversation what Lenica hinted at, that different people come for different reasons. Some may be immigrants, some may be refugees, especially I'm thinking about children and families coming from the Northern Triangle that many times they're considered immigrants when they should not be considered immigrants. These people are refugees that are running for their lives, quite literally. So how do you think all of this will play out in the future?
Well, I mean, we've seen some reports recently of when immigrants that were already on their way from wherever country they were from heard that Trump became president-elect, they started rushing towards the border, increasing numbers in that way. I think immigration right now is changing in demographic. From historically, when we talk about immigration, we talk about Mexican immigration, Chicanos, and we talk about that population. We have an increase. We are seeing now, just in numbers, an increase in Central American immigration, particularly among Hondurans. That's because of human rights issues, crime, impunity within their governments, completely different issues associated with violence and human rights violations that are happening within different regions. I think that people are going to continue to immigrate and go to the U.S., but it's going to be more on a case-by-case basis where individuals start weighing their options and weighing what is actually happening in the U.S. and what the news is coming out of the U.S. You know, if people are realizing that what Trump proposed on deporting people wasn't actually feasible / not possible, not going on, they're probably going to continue to say, like, oh, like, why shouldn't I continue to try to escape the current situation in my country if they're obviously not going to, they're not going with the same laws to deport people, you know, what Trump proposed. I mean, I think it really matters on the individual and the case by case, and specifically country by country and what's going on.
One extra point on this is, interestingly, immigration from Mexico had really reversed in the last years. And so more people were really going back than coming here. This is something that obviously Trump didn't really clarify in the campaign. Nobody really knows about this from the people who probably voted because of this reason for him. But one possible perversity of this, let's say that he really imposes serious restrictions to Mexican exports, that NAFTA is really fundamentally changed, which we also have to see. It's not so easy to undo the integration of these two economies. But let's say that that happens and that the economy in Mexico, as you know, is not really, it's very sort of fragile. So with really worst economic performance there, you could see a backlash and, you know, start seeing more the urge to come to this country. So that's really the perversity of this. I mean, I think that, you know, for a long time during the Cold War period, the U.S. had this clarity that if Mexico was stable, that was a good thing for this country because, you know, for two reasons. One is that, you know, communism was not going to really arrived to Mexico and to other countries around Mexico. And the other is, you know, this, you know, violence. And, you know? So, you know, that's what I see as perverse, because if you are really hurt in Mexico, this is going to, in the end, hurt back. We are just so closely tied already. And that would be a perverse outcome of this. You know, just, again, I don't think we have a way to predict how the economy is going to be hurt. We already know that just when Trump won, the peso collapsed by, I don't know, what's 14% or something like that. And that, so obviously this is going to hurt the Mexico's economy. And then if some of the policies on trade are going to be reversed in a way that it's hurting our economy there, you know, that's going to have an impact here.
Yeah, I was actually going to say something very similar, and I would just skew it a little bit and note that, you know, Trump has proposed the wall as an answer to not only to immigration, but also to stop the flow of drugs. So the wall is going to stop these two things. It's going to stop people. It's going to stop substances, which means that there will be more drugs in Latin America that potentially would have come here. So a lot of people that I know in Mexico and other parts of Latin America who are part of sort of drug policy reform conversations are concerned about increased insecurity, increased addiction, increased crime in Latin America with a Trump presidency, because it will, because of this, and also the perverse increase of the need to leave because of these insecurities and violence and the desire of young people, families, to send their kids north to get out of these difficult situations. So I think, again, we're kind of talking, this is all speculation at this point, but there is enough scholarship and evidence to show that when the border wall and when border policy is tightened, we can sort of look back at different parts of, you know, recent history with Operation Intercept and all of these sort of things that were put in play under the Nixon administration, we can see increased insecurity south of the border and increased kind of disruption of daily life for ordinary people in terms of labor, in terms of work, in terms of getting in contact with their family, which will likely only increase the desire to leave. So there's this kind of, these sort of intensities on both ends of what may happen in the future. But I do think that the issue of drugs is really pivotal to the question of immigration and how that will be experienced in Latin America if there's increased interception of drugs at the border through the wall and whatever other policies are put into place.
Also, one thing that we have to remember is that it's never simply a case of sending, it's also a case of pulling. There are reasons, you know, if there weren't actually jobs that people could find once they got here, they may not be great jobs, but they're still jobs. If people weren't making a calculation that they could at least survive here, they wouldn't come. And nobody wants to leave their home. Like, people don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I really just want to go to the U.S. I mean, you know, they leave because they don't have any options. So we have to think not only of the, you know, what's going on there, but also what is bringing them here. The same thing with the drugs. Why are drugs flowing into the U.S.? Because people are consuming them, you know. So it's a two-way street. And, you know, what will it do to our economy if we no longer have the influx of immigrants willing to take some of the jobs that...
And the flow of drugs has gone down. There's been so many lies about the flow of drugs. Heroin and meth have gone up in the past two decades. But marijuana, in part because of legalization, likely, and other initiatives, has actually gone down, you know, tremendously. I can't say that anymore because that's a Trump word.
Yeah.
You know, there are these words
huge,
that I no longer
can
speak.
Can't say tremendously.
But
no one can say
but
bigly.
Marijuana and cocaine have gone down. So this idea that there's just this continuous flow uninterrupted is not true.
Can I add, before I get to your question, can I add one more thing about the border? Because I became a little bit obsessed with the question of the wall in the last few weeks. And, you know, when the campaign was going on, I did go into the Trump website and I read the whole section on the wall and I thought, this is ludicrous, this is incredible. How can this even be in a website? I didn't take it seriously, you know. And then
You know, now I've spent the last few weeks reading a little bit more about this. So we do have the Secure Border Act of 2006, and we do know a lot of things about the effect of the wall. And that's something which, you know, I want to write on this, because it turns out, for example, there's a group in Arizona that has been tracking every death, every single death of migrants on the U.S. side. And we know, with very, very clear, compelling evidence from the work they've done, that what the wall, in the case of 2008, 2010, when they finished that fence, if you don't want to call it a wall, it's a fence, it has pedestrian parts, it has vehicle sections, and it has a whole strategy of greater enforcement of the wall. What it has done is it has produced an incredible increase in the deaths of migrants mm-hmm. that look for other routes, you know, into more dangerous areas of the desert. You know, as migration has been going down, the deaths have kept on going up.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, we never took this seriously, I think, as in the campaign. We could have appealed to Arizona voters, telling them, do you realize that this promise of the wall would kill people? Are you willing to go with a candidate who wants to
care.
Kill people? You know,
I
well, at least move
care.
It into that moral stand.
Yeah.
I mean, the other side of it is we have not articulated the whole, you know, fact that most of the undocumented migration to the U.S. today is visa overstays.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with, and most of the drugs pass in the trucks that are going through the legal crossing sites. Mm-hmm. That's where the drugs are coming in. So we were, you know, unable to articulate, I think, as you know, as scholars, as intellectuals, as public, you know, all these facts, as we're complaining about the facts. But sorry, okay. I'm supposed to be moderating. Bruce.
So I want to pick on Beatrice and Alberto, and let's talk about the Mexican election, which is coming up, mm-hmm. and how does all this play into the upcoming election, and in particular, my understanding, and I could be wrong, you'll correct me if I am, is that NAFTA had some negative effects in Mexico, that certain parts of the agricultural sector were negatively affected. So how do you see this playing out? Do you see the parties competing in any dimension related to any of these issues that we've been talking about, the trade, the immigration, the wall? And also, my understanding is that on the southern border, you have issues with immigrants coming across from Central America, some of them staying. Do you see that as playing out in any way, shape, or form? Because what we're seeing across the world is that, you know, Trump, Brexit, Trump, mm-hmm. Marine Le Pen, mm-hmm. the defeat of potentially the referendum in Italy, you know, there's a kind of nationalism that is creeping across a lot of democracies. Does any of that play out in Mexico at all? So,
yes, sure. This is a great question. I think that in Mexico, if it's certainly going to be to play out, but if it does, I think it's going to strengthen the left. So we're not going to see sort of a populist right wing. You know, sort of politician. And just because the PAN was in power, then the PRI, you know, was in power, and both of them have followed right-wing economic agendas in the sense that, you know, supporting NAFTA, supporting globalization, and so on. So certainly what we see is that it might strengthen the candidacy of López Obrador, maybe. He's been contending for the presidency for a long time. And I think that's something that slightly is going to strengthen him. Nationalism has been really a big in his agenda and in the agenda of the left. And again, you know, the question is how much room of for maneuver Mexico truly has, which is very different from the U.S. I think our economy really depends so heavily on trading with the U.S. especially, and on manufacturing exports. We used to be more dependent on oil 25 years ago, and I think that the globalization was painful for Mexico, NAFTA was painful for Mexico, but the economy just completely transformed. So if you see today what are the main exports are really coming from manufacturing, and again, it's when you think about how this is done, it's really a lot of things come from the, you know, it's integration with the U.S. and Mexico. It's not all done in Mexico. Most of it comes from the U.S., then it's integrated in Mexico, and then it comes back. Mm-hmm. And to undo that is going to be very hard. We don't have that. The economy is not really been booming at all. Mexico didn't really have that huge commodity boom as other Latin American countries had. So our economy is so, it's in a way fragile and dependent on this. So I don't see that much room for maneuver. So yes, in this course, yes, maybe it would have to again talk about Pemex and the whole, you know, so reversing that part, and maybe a little bit of more protection in agriculture, which actually would be beneficial for Mexico, but I don't see big reversals there. Maybe I'm wrong.
You want me, my opinion?
Yes. Oh.
So yes. The one thought I have on this, which, you know, it's a very interesting question, is on the one hand, you know, people don't realize, for example, how difficult for Mexico competition from China was.
Yes.
during the last 10, 15 years. So, for example, the collapse of TPP is actually a good thing for Mexico, provided we keep on having NAFTA in place. And to the extent that NAFTA is kind of locked in and it's not so easy to undo a lot of this, you know, it is actually, you know, and again, you know, some of the things which are paradoxical about the nativist approach that Trump took in the campaign is that many of the things he was attributing to Mexico were actually caused by China, rather than, you know, those were the exports that were really, you know, shifting manufacturing away from some of these areas. The second thing, I mean, and it's kind of, you know, it's not a complete answer to your question, but I do think that, you know, one question that at least in my mind comes up is, is it possible for these insurgent populists to come out and, you know, so we have an established political system in Mexico, which is a very consolidated three-party system. You know, would it be possible to see this kind of insurgent populist come out, some millionaire or some that says, oh, Trump could do it, you know, Berlusconi did it 15 years ago, I can do it too. I happen to think that the likely scenario is one more of this voter dissatisfaction, people who are very fed up with the political system. I might give space actually to this very interesting emerging, you know, young leaders like Kumamoto, for example, if some of you have followed this guy who did run a campaign with $20,000 and won a legislative seat, 20,000 pesos actually, not dollars, all through social media, very young guy, 24, 25 years old. And this kind of possibilities of emergent kind of, that would maybe shatter the very comfortable oligopoly that is ruling Mexico.
Yes.
So I would say that's possibly a good outcome out of this.
Can I have a follow-up on that? Do we know whether, as in the United States, there's a shift to more of the news reading going on Facebook or
absolutely
social media? So is the same trend
yes
there? So the potential is there?
Yes.
No, very, very dramatic, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think people read newspapers anymore.
Yeah. And in Latin America, those social platforms have become ways for students and the young population to start revolutions. You know, like our president in Guatemala, Otto Perez Molina, was ousted like 2 or 3 days before the new president was supposed to come in. And it was through a social media campaign that students at the USAC, which is like the public national university, kind of started, you know, and it's in at least in Guatemala, through that campaign, it was just so much easier to diffuse that information because everyone checks Facebook, and even the telephone companies will offer you like prepaid packets where you buy a certain amount of, or you pay a certain amount to get a certain amount of minutes, and you get free Facebook for 2 or 3 days. You know, like they know people use it, so they're using social media as an incentive for people to buy those packets, but that's because, you know, people are using it all the time to get their information.
Which is good and bad.
Yeah.
There's a lot of misinformation.
Yes. So about this wall, I think we all think it's extremely unlikely that Mexico is going to pay for it. And I'm wondering what you think the reaction will be to Trump's reputation because of this. Do you think that he'll experience some backlash when, if it happens at all, we're the ones paying for it?
That's a good question.
I don't think it'll happen.
That's a great question.
I don't think it'll happen. I go on record, I could be totally wrong.
It's just too expensive.
I just think that's going to disappear as an issue. He's going to just say, oh, we've got enough enforcement. I don't know. What do you think?
I think he might be a little, you know, pieces here or there, you know, depending on the governors who are really of the different states. So, but obviously not the entire. I mean, it's just, I think it's impossible. It's just too expensive. And as I say, the geography, the terrain is just simply,
I mean,
extremely difficult.
Build that wall is a bully club. Mm-hmm. You know, it is something to hit people with. I don't think we're gonna have a wall.
This is another opportunity, I think, for coalition building, because a lot of the environmentalists who are concerned about the environment, and these are very precarious lands where there's, you know, rivers, the wall would have to go through rivers. I mean, it would have a tremendous environmental destruction. So I see an opportunity for people who, you know, have been a part of, you know, sort of more traditional environmental politics to become more concerned and involved with border politics that are more kind of human focused, because I think they understand the implications of the wall in terms of wildlife, in terms of natural resources, et cetera, the devastating effect it already has had on the planet, you know, and in particularly in the Southwest. And as it has too with human lives being dying in more extreme areas of the desert. So I would hope that those of you, so I always reach out to students who are concerned about the environment and environmental justice, see this issue of the wall as being a really fundamental issue of our time.
I think you had your hand up for quite a while, and we do have probably time for like three more questions at most, so let's make them brief.
I tutor a little bit with ABLA, helping Stanford maintenance staff learn English. And one of the questions that has come up a lot recently that I don't really know how to answer, and I thought I'd pass along, is how do I, with my education level, my resources, my situation in life, protect myself, my family, and my community? I want to fight, but how, on a practical level?
Very good question.
Do you want me to take three questions?
Sure,
and then,
sure.
Okay, so let's take three questions, and then we'll wrap up. So there's another, oh, there's two more on that side. Yeah, so, yeah.
This is an unusual one. I agree that over the next 4 years, we're really going to have to be vigilant and fight hard. But suppose we're successful, and 2 or 3 years from now, we have a very frustrated Trump. My fear is that he'll turn to racism and scapegoating. Are there any things we can work with him on? You know, I thought maybe infrastructure, but when you look in detail at it, his infrastructure plan is not that attractive. But I think we have to think about that. So it is not an outcome that we all fear, having seen it happen in so many other places.
Can you hear me? Okay, so of the three kind of hot topic issues, NAFTA, wall, and deportation, it sounds like NAFTA is going to be tough to change. Probably not a whole lot will change. It sounds like the wall might be more of a half measure than a real thing. Do you think that the uptick in deportation rates, those forces will actually be implemented?
And let's take one last question on that side, and then we'll do a round of everyone.
I had a Republican who told me that killing trespassers is legal, So therefore, Trump was going to deploy targeting drones with infrared along the border and just shoot down anybody who crossed it, kind of like Berlin or something. And then the other question was supposedly something like 30,640 votes are the difference in three states that would have swung the election to Clinton. And the New York Times said, besides a lot more white voters turning out, there were a substantial amount of Latinos and blacks, enough that would have swung the vote in her favor, who voted for Obama in 2008 and 12, who did not come out to vote for Hillary. Mm-hmm. Even though I would think they would think that Trump is far worse than Romney or McCain. So why do you think they stayed at home?
So I've been listening to our friend and colleague Gary Segura talk about this for a while. He's the head of Latino Decisions, so it's a Latino polling company. So he contests the New York Times numbers about how many Latinos actually voted for Trump. So that's to start with. He says it's much smaller than they figured, and that has to do with their methodology in exit polling. So it is, I think, a smaller number.
That's,
yeah, so, yes. And so it's not that they didn't, it's just not quite as large. I think that this is why I was saying about electoral politics. I think we have underplayed the necessity of electoral politics. So a lot of African Americans did just stay home. I think some of them thought, oh, well, Trump's not going to win anyway. But I think some of them we just need to do a much better job of understanding how any one of our actions affects everybody else. As far as how you protect yourself, that's a much harder question. And I think at the very least, this comes from all of the reading that I do about Nazi-era Berlin. I think people need to start strengthening their social networks and develop contingency plans for in case a parent is suddenly taken. Where do the kids go? You know, who will be there? It's not an easy thing to do. It means you have to talk to your children but we've seen it happen before. I'm terribly afraid that it could happen again. And this is why I think your question is important, but I think we really need to strengthen our social networks and each one of us and figure out what kinds of contingency plans we have.
Going to your question about how we can answer some of the issues that are going on with limited resources or with supposedly limited education or knowledge about how things work, one good thing that I saw in social media recently is just some of my friends were publishing or passing around this PDF with links to resources that people could access, you know? And what I really liked about that PDF was one, that it kind of addressed the expansion of issues within America, but also the willingness to just recognize that what something that you may be facing may be completely different than what someone else may be facing, you know? And I think the importance there is also community building, you know, recognizing the sort of resources that are available here within your community. I know specifically in Palo Alto, East Palo Alto, in this region, there are a lot of free resources for people to look for lawyers or people to help them with paperwork, people to help them with translation, and things like that. So I think being unafraid to ask for help is very important, especially now. And then kind of taking that and also being unafraid to look for help from your children, you know, or kind of put your children in that space where it's look, sometimes I may need you to ask questions for me. And it's something it's done in Latino households, you know. When there's just a difference in types of education or ability to communicate from one generation to the next, you know? And just it's kind of like you're raising a mini activist to be able to know the resources and know who to call or what needs to happen, you know? Unfortunately, if the separation of families does happen, your kid also needs to be prepared to know what they can do as well, you know? So empowering yourself as an individual, being unafraid to ask for help, but also knowing and letting your kids know that it's okay for them to know these resources as well, and it's okay for them to ask for help, because they will need it if it does happen.
I do think the last question, I think NAFTA is going to be tough to undo. The wall, I don't think, is going to really happen in the way that he envisions it. But I do think there's going to be a widening of deportation policy, and that is going to make asking for help very hard, because people are going to be afraid. One of the things that I think has to happen is that Stanford, other institutions, cities that are calling themselves sanctuary cities, really need to take a real leadership position that's not just symbolic, that's not just a letter that's distributed, but is actually has some teeth, because that is the thing that I think is most likely to happen, and it's already happened under Obama to astonishing levels. And so, and that's without the hateful rhetoric. So just imagine what could happen under a Trump presidency. And so having contingency plans, absolutely, but also recognizing that it's going to create a situation of a lot of fear and anxiety that will make seeking help even more difficult than it already is.
Which means that when we strengthen our social networks, that goes without saying, not on Facebook.
Yeah.
In person.
To that point, I think that even though we are saying NAFTA is going to be very hard to reverse, that doesn't mean that there are not going to be aspects of it that are going to be reversed. And so for sure there is going to be an impact on that dimension, and that's going to be harder for Mexico. Although there are some industries here that are also going to be hit, but for sure that's going to happen. Maybe it's going to hit avocado producers, you know. So there is always a lot of interest groups here that are going to benefit from blocking exports from Mexico. And that's what NAFTA did, actually. It just blocked all these interest groups and was able to negotiate some sort of overarching package. A lot of people were, different industries, groups were hurt. So that's, we are going to see that happening, and that is going to hit different areas of Mexico in different ways. And that might be really serious for some regions. So think of, for example, the avocado producers in Michoacán, who are already being hit so much by the violence there, no? So that's one point. The other is, it just made me think of the, so it's not really probably physically a wall, but we are certainly going to see changes in the way the border is enforced. And that's going to be, I think, increase human rights violations, and it's going to really create a lot of sort of stress for those people who want to come to the U.S. And so that, I think, in terms of action, I think that being, really active in terms of defense of human rights, working for, lawyers really become very essential in this in this dimension. And so I'm happy you mentioned all these resources. I mean, for sure, that's really very important. And lastly, I think that the best I think is these California voices I've heard, from mayors, from all these sort of different leaders that say, not here. It's not going to happen here. And I, that really could put the most serious sort of constraints. Obviously, if the Supreme Court, moves, more conservative, we might be even, see changes there, because they can block it with some limits, no? Because, this is still a federal system in which, federal laws apply. So, but to me, that's really the answer, is really local politics and just, work with those mayors, with those leaders who are really willing to say, not here, no? Because Trump is not really the U.S. I mean, what we really see is, he didn't win the, popular vote, but if you really see, even in really red, states, you start to see the geography of that, and you see a lot of cities in those red states are blue. I mean, this is really still you know, a combination of voices. And I think what we really need to do is really engage with those voices that really don't want Trump to, you know, sort of invade all the spaces, no? Yes.
So let me give Francisco the last word. And before I do it, I do want to remind you, you know, Francisco is the executive director of our union with, what, 1,000 members?
A little over 1,000.
So we have a little bit over 1,000 workers that are usually invisible to a lot of us. I hope we start seeing them and reaching out, but please, Francisco.
Sure, and on this note, I wanted to say that we're a resource as an organization, as SEIU, not just our local, but internationally or nationally, our union is a resource. What we're doing here at the state level, we're actually mobilizing to work on creating stronger protections in the state for these types of, or dealing with immigration at as much as we can at the state level, and then doing trainings on how to create that support network that we were talking about in terms of what, if certain things happen, what are the next steps? So that's kind of going on as an organization nationally that we're working on. So I wanted to leave it that we serve here as a resource, so hopefully we can work on these issues together.
That's great.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you all for being here and being so patient. We hope we can really continue having these conversations as we move along. I want to thank Roger, who's somewhere in the back, Belinda, the FSI staff, the class staff who made this possible, and of course, all of you for coming here, and thank you to the panelists.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you liked this episode, please review us on iTunes. It helps others to find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.